Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to a new series of Reading Our Times, the podcast about books, about ideas about us. This series, we're looking at playing God, science, religion, and the future of humanity. We're going to be talking about scientific immortality, alien life, animal personhood, the rise in mental ill health, and the soul of AI. And underlying it all, we're going to be thinking about the question that lies at the heart of Reading Our Times. How are we to understand our human condition? The possibility of alien life seems more possible every day. There are around 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and each one has an estimated 100 billion stars, although the precise figures are much disputed. Many of them have planets orbiting them. Humans detected the first exoplanets, that is, a planet orbiting a sun other than our own sun, about 30 years ago. But as of today, we found at least 5,000. And the one planet we know that has developed life, our own, did so really quickly. Indeed, almost as soon as conditions allowed it to. Of course, distance, time, evolutionary bottlenecks and civilizational implosion may preclude our ever making contact with an alien civilization. But either way, the idea that we are alone seems increasingly far-fetched. What would alien life mean for us? What would alien intelligence mean for us? And in particular, what would it mean for the kind of religious belief that insists that God is real and has an active interest in our little planet and our little species? Andrew Davison is the Starbridge Associate Professor in Theology and Natural Sciences at Cambridge University and the author of a superb new book entitled Astrobiology and Christian Doctrine, exploring the implications of life in the universe. Andrew, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I alluded in my introduction to some of the numbers in this whole area, but let's start with you giving us a bit of an idea of the scale and the probability when we're talking about alien life. How likely is it that alien life, or indeed alien intelligence, might exist somewhere?
I think the numbers are really important, and it's one of the reasons that I got writing about this subject and have taken it into my teaching, that maybe there are about 200 billion stars in our galaxy, something like that, maybe 200 billion galaxies in the observable universe as well. So that's an astonishingly large number. And it turns out that a lot of these stars have got planets around them, so we didn't really know that until it was proven, because we saw another planet around another star. For much of the 19th century and before, the theory of how stars formed would not really have produced planets. Then in the 20th century, it shifted a little bit towards thinking that planets might happen routinely. But it wasn't until, 1995 that we found the first planet around another sun. And since then, I think even the people who were thinking it would go in that direction have been surprised just how ubiquitous these planets are. So if you do the maths, this changes a little bit from year to year, but I think these figures are more or less right. Maybe 20% of stars out there are a bit like the sun, and 20% of those have got a planet around them that will be a bit like the Earth. So if you do the multiplication, you get up to something like 16 billion billion Earth-like planets around sun-like stars in the observable universe. So that's the number. It might be off by an order of magnitude in one direction or the other, but it shows that the number of places, the number of cradles where life could evolve is really enormous. Now, whether life has evolved in any of those places is a different question.
Well, there is such a thing known as the Fermi paradox, isn't there? Named after the Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi, which can basically be boiled down to the question, so where is everybody then? If there's 16 billion billion potentially life-supporting planets out there, where is everyone?
Well, the thing to note about the Fermi paradox is that Fermi's presupposition there is that there's a good chance that there would be life elsewhere. If that wasn't there in the background, he wouldn't be asking the question in the first place. Well, it could be, of course, that life doesn't happen that often. So if it only occurred in one in a billion places, then it might be that the nearest life is a very long way away. That would still be, what, 16 billion inhabited places in the observable universe. It seems to me the chances that life only gets going and, you know, the chances are one in 16 billion billion, well, we haven't got many reference points, except that life did get going on Earth surprisingly early. I mean, almost infeasibly early, as soon as the conditions were half habitable. And we're only just out of the Hadean epoch, which is Hades-like epoch. So that maybe is one extra bit of information. Why aren't things showing up? I mean, there may be reticence. It may be that other creatures are defensive and don't want to give themselves away. That might be quite sensible. There may be an ethical consideration that it's good for letting other creatures get on with their life and evolution and intellectual development. There are all sorts of other reasons. I mean, the rather frightening one is that civilizations don't get beyond a certain level before they destroy themselves.
Yes.
And if we were to look around on Earth at the moment, there would be, unfortunately, you know, good reasons to suppose that that might be a trajectory that's taken.
Yes.
And of course, at the moment, we're thinking about intelligent life, and it's quite possible that the bottleneck is between the evolution of life and then it becoming intelligent. Now, has it only happened once upon Earth? It certainly only happened once that produces a species that records podcasts, for instance. quite whether there are other forms of intelligence that are just too different from our own to be able to recognize them, for instance, amongst octopuses. There's a good case to be said that they are surprisingly intelligent, but their bodies and their brains are so different, very dispersed neural system, that we just can't recognize their form of intelligence. I've certainly stopped eating octopus on that basis.
Yes, we had in a previous discussion Simon Conway Morris talking about convergence in evolution and how, at least on Earth, there seems to be some kind of underlying order that has steered life towards mind, if you like, and it's a reason at least to believe that's happened elsewhere. I guess distance is another reason, though, isn't it? Because it takes an awfully long time to communicate over these distances. So presumably it's highly possible they are out there. It's just that the distance for communication precludes any serious contact.
Yes, certainly on the business of interstellar travel, I take that line. Not that I'm an expert in this field, but it seems to me we really shouldn't underestimate how difficult it would be to travel those sorts of distances because of the speeds that would be involved, the enormous risk that comes from traveling at those speeds if you knock into even the tiniest particle. So that's one reason why my work doesn't take in questions of contact and UFOs or whatever we're supposed to call them nowadays. We are searching for signals pretty intently, and although every now and again someone says they've found something that looks a bit anomalous, nothing seems to have convinced the scientific community yet. No. But then if you think about the Earth, we had this period when we were broadcasting with radio, and we suppose we're doing that to some extent now. But who's to say that in even just a few decades, we won't be using radio anymore because everything will be through fiber optic cables, for instance. So it's possible that the heydays of broadcasting using radio waves from the end of the 20th century, everyone was saying, well, why aren't we picking this up from elsewhere? But it may be that that was just a relatively short phase that the Earth went through, and that in a certain sense it'll go quiet before too long.
Because radio waves are the kind of thing that other civilizations could listen into, as it were, right?
Yes, and there are people who actively want to, and to some extent are, sending out messages. And there's a really surprisingly large body of ethical discussion in journals about whether that's a good idea or not. Mm. And that, you know, that comes back to the Fermi paradox. There may be good reasons if other creatures have the sorts of propensities towards violence and domination that we do.
Yes.
It might be a good idea just to keep ourselves to ourselves.
Don't let them know that we're here. Yes, I've heard that argument as well. Well, let me ask one more totally speculative and very unfair question before we get into the meat of our discussion, which is, okay, you're a betting man then. Your bet that there is life in our galaxy?
I think the fact that I've spent the last, 7 years of my life thinking about this, writing a book, investing in it quite heavily in teaching, whether I wanted to bet or not, you could see from that my instincts clearly align in the direction that I'd be surprised if there wasn't other life out there.
Yeah.
The wonderful thing about this topic, say from a theological point of view, is that it really invigorates all sorts of old questions. So is sin inevitable? Does it matter that we're the only or not the only thing in the universe? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? All these questions, I think, even if we never found life elsewhere, would have benefited from asking them in terms of that frame.
Absolutely. And that's what I took so strongly from your book, this wealth of potential thought experiments to help us look at familiar questions and familiar problems from fresh perspectives. It is worth pointing out, isn't it, that for many people, this seems like a quintessentially modern question. You know, this is the kind of thing we ask ourselves once we've turned very high specification telescopes to the heavens and once we've been to the moon. That's when we start really thinking about potential for alien life. It really isn't, is it? This tradition, at least within Christian theology, goes back a very long time, doesn't it?
The earliest writer that I found thinking about life beyond Earth, well, there are two of them in the 15th century, around the middle of the 15th century. I don't know of anything earlier, and it is a period that I spend quite a lot of time reading. So I'd be delighted if a listener is able to point out earlier discussions. But I think that's where it begins in Christianity, about 1450. And Judaism and Islam, certainly some centuries earlier. So I think that's really important. And one of the things that most surprised me when I started taking this on as a research topic is that really Christian theologians have not stopped asking this question and talking about it across all those centuries. And if anything's frustrating about the work that's been produced, is that it's mainly just asides. People consider it, they're generally not worried about it enough to write a great deal, and they just sort of note it in passing. So that's why I thought there was some value in writing a more in-depth book. But again, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? That rather than this being something that the Christian tradition, as these other traditions as well, were either afraid of or not thinking about at all, if anything, they took it in their stride so much that they didn't write whole books. You might get a sentence here, a page there at most.
Yes. I think that's a very interesting phenomenon too. I remember conducting research interviews many, many years ago in which a respondent, an atheist respondent, said to me that they really hoped that we would discover alien life because as far as he was concerned, that was a knockdown argument against Christian faith. He believed that speculation about alien life elsewhere in the cosmos, particularly alien intelligence, would really punch a hole through Christian thought. And the point you make there is that, I mean, we'll come on to whether it does or not, but certainly historically, it's not been considered anything like a knockdown argument. It's just been something worth pondering, right?
Yes, it's there, for instance, in Trollope's Barchester Towers, so the quintessentially Victorian novel, when he wants to have some educated but not extraordinarily different characters, the representative of the middle class, I suppose, talking in a drawing room about the sorts of things that people talked about in drawing rooms, he has them talking about life beyond Earth and at one moment the theological significance of it. Or we might point to John Wilkin, who was Bishop of Chester, master of an Oxford College and Cambridge College, but also one of the founders of the Royal Society. So he is not a marginal figure, either ecclesiastically or in the scientific world of his day. And he wrote one of the longest books on the topic, which was actually about life on the moon. So no points for the science there, although he was a considerable scientist. But the book remains relevant because he's asking what's the theological significance of life beyond Earth, even if he's got the site wrong.
So one of the reasons given why the discovery of alien life would be a threat to Christianity is the idea that Christianity in some way hinges on the belief in human uniqueness or human superiority, particularly human intelligence, and that if we were to meet other creatures that were not just intelligent, but possibly super intelligent, it would destroy any conviction in our uniqueness and it would destroy any belief in our supreme intelligence. Why is that not a threat?
Well, we can come at this from several different angles, I think, and one of them is about position and the idea of the Earth at the centre of the universe, and that obviously is shown to be wrong by Copernicus, and then we discover other galaxies and so on much later on. That's one angle we could talk about. The other would be about the image of God and the idea that somehow we're not made in the image of God if there are other creatures that are like us. Well, I mean, take the second one first. I do encounter this from students who find the idea of their sense of their self really diminished by the idea that there could be other things like them. They're often religious students and they're interested in the beginning of Genesis and the idea that human beings are made in the image of God. And they're assuming that that's a competitive thing, you know, that human beings are in the image of God because the other animals aren't. And it's true that in that biblical text, no other creature is described as being in the image of God. But I don't think, either on the basis of that text, and certainly not on the basis of what's been done with it down centuries and centuries of thinking about it, requires it to be competitive. There are lots of different accounts of what it means. I mean, one is about capacity to enter into relationship. Another is about being active and an agent in the world, God's representative in the world. And historically, the dominant one has been that the image of God rests in certain capacities like freedom, intellect, memory, will, and so on. I just don't see that any of those are in any way diminished because there are other creatures that would bear the image of God. So even on Earth, if dolphins turn out to have a rich inner life, if chimpanzees turn out to have this extraordinary spiritual quality or whatever, wherever we point to the image of God, I don't feel that I'm in any way pulled down because other things are lifted up.
So let me ask another speculative question on the back of that. This is drawing on another interview we did a few series ago with Frans de Waal, the great Dutch primatologist, talking about emotions in primates and other animals. And one of his strong arguments is that the old behaviourist idea that these other species don't feel emotions is complete nonsense, and they do. There is growing evidence that other primates and other mammals have emotions and intelligence. Would you agree that if that were the case, other species could share something of the image of God?
Well, the medievals get there ahead of us because they already say that there's more than one way in which creatures bear a divine likeness. If you're committed to the idea that everything about everything comes from God, including all the characterfulness of things, then you're committed to some sort of sense of exemplarity. And following Augustine of Hippo, people have often associated the image of God with having memory, intellect, and will. And as I say, I'm not threatened by the idea that that could be extended beyond humankind. I'm not sure that there is evidence of all of those things, but there would be for some. But they also said that everything was bore the trace of God. For instance, inasmuch as it was one, inasmuch as it was intelligible, inasmuch as it was good or beautiful or ordered, for instance, all of these things were thought to bear the fingerprints of God. So absolutely, and not only do I think we can think about ways in which other creatures bear the likeness of God in some sense, I think we're absolutely committed to, we have to, from a Christian perspective. I'll go back to that one other thing that I mentioned about the question of centrality, and the claim is sometimes made that this whole astronomical picture, even before you bring other life into it, is terribly destructive of the Christian vision of the world because we're no longer at the center of things. But I think it's really important to say that that's pretty much a definition of sin from theological viewpoints, that to think that you're the center of everything, to make it all about you, is exactly what, you know, a life of prayer and discipleship and faith is supposed to wean you away from. God's the center of all things. And within the medieval view of the world, the center wasn't particularly the distinguished place. It was where all the rubbish fell to. It was the sort of like the pit almost. And the extremities were the glorious places where the sun was and God and the angels and so on. For all sorts of reasons, I think the idea of one's geographical place in the universe and like geometrical place in the universe is not important.
Yes. One of the reasons why Freud was so spectacularly wrong when he claimed that Copernicus somehow demoted human beings when, as you say, if anything, he did the opposite, really.
Well, Freud's hilarious here because, as I remember, he says there were three great demotions. There was Copernicus, there was Darwin, and then, hey presto, who's the third one? Yeah, Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
So
slightly self-serving, that piece of intellectual history. As I mentioned, there is arguments about finding alien life, intelligent life, would threaten Christianity. There is a counter-argument, which is that discovering alien life would actually bolster at least the likelihood of God, as it would suggest that intelligent life is not simply an accident, but it's, as it were, woven into the very fabric or the purpose of the universe. What do you think about that one?
I think it might work or have force for some people, but I'm not sure that you could convince someone who didn't find it convincing that they should find it convincing. Certainly the intelligibility of the universe would be important. And yeah, I suppose in that sense, the fact that it seems to be ordered towards diversity and beauty and characterfulness and so on, that certainly invokes from me a sense of wonder and gratitude. I suppose what I'm saying is, it's enough that there's the one example of intelligent life that can appreciate beauty and be good and do ill and repent and so on. I'm not sure that seeing that massively multiplied would make a huge difference to me.
I mean, I buy that, and that's very kind of appropriately cautious response. But there's a part of me that thinks, just by basic logic, it's easier to dismiss one of something as an accident. Something happens once, only once. Well, who knows whether it was an accident or not. If something repeatedly keeps on happening in your life or in your house or in your country or on your earth, on your galaxy, it looks like it's not an accident. It looks like it might be set up for that.
Mm. Well, there's an essay by C.S. Lewis from the middle of the 20th century called Religion and Rocketry. So he was interested in these questions and he explored them in his science fiction trilogy, the Cosmic Trilogy. But he's also got this one essay about theology and life beyond Earth. And he says, well, it could go either way. If there's only one example of life, then people can say, oh, look, life's just this absurd accident. You know, don't make too much from it. Alternatively, if the universe is absolutely full of life, people could say, oh, well, there's nothing special about you. Following that argument about things need to be unique in order to be special, then they're no longer special anymore.
Let me move to a slightly different area then, because you've actually already mentioned sin and salvation, because there is the idea that discovering alien life, alien intelligence, might influence one's view on the existence of God. It might influence one's view on the uniqueness and significance of humans. But Christianity is more than about God and human uniqueness. It's a story of sin and it's a story of salvation. So what would you say about the idea of if we made contact, if we got to know other alien intelligent life, do you think that they'd be fallen? Do you think they'd be sinful? Do you think that would even have any meaning for them whatsoever?
This is an interesting question for me, and in a sense a difficult one, because I'm by nature an optimist. And yet on this question, I find myself pretty pessimistic, in as much as I think once someone has taken a bad step, a selfish step, a cruel step, these things get embedded, they get perpetuated. There is certainly a contagion of the good as well, and I would always want to stress that, and we should all do our best to try and perpetuate that chain reaction. But once you've got violence, you get violence in return. Once you've got selfishness, you get selfishness in return. So for that reason, I think it would be quite difficult to imagine it not being widespread. I keep coming back to the medievals because they're just such creative thinkers and also some of the theologians that I know best. And Aquinas, for instance, Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, thinks that material things kind of fall apart. So there's a kind of propensity towards corruption. And he makes a link there between corruption that would be death and also corruption that would be wrongdoing. And also just being animals. We have passions. To say that we're animals isn't to dismiss us. We're a very peculiar kind of animal. But whatever else we are, we're animals. So the medievals, and Aquinas to be an example, but this is actually goes back further, and plenty of people think this, say that the only hope that human beings ever had for not doing a wrong thing was a gift from God that would have preserved them. So being in a natural state, there's always the propensity to wrongdoing. It's going to happen. So I suppose that's the point. If there is civilizations that have not gone wrong, then I think it would have to be a very theological answer to that question, that they had cooperated with the gift of grace and had been preserved by something that can only be understood in theological terms. Mm. My instinct is to say that outside of any gift of grace, creatures unfortunately tend to go wrong before too long.
I mean, I guess much of it depends on how one reads the story of the fall in the book of Genesis and then the doctrine of sin. And I guess if those many Christians who read the fall is in some way a historical or prehistorical event, and for them, it would be therefore arguably unique to our particular species and our particular planet. Now, I personally don't read it that way. And I think if you read it, as I'm inclined to, as a story describing the state of our human condition, and that fallenness is something that is part of that human condition. I think, at least from my point of view, it becomes quite likely that other intelligent species, particularly at species that are relational, that are inherently social, will encounter something that looks very like sin, effectively not treating the other as they should be treated. And therefore, our doctrine of it, our understanding of it, is of course local to who we are and where we are. But I kind of think that it would have a resonance with other intelligent, social aliens that we might meet.
And it will be interesting to talk to your primatologist about whether these sorts of categories have any bearing beyond the human. And there's the whole question of how universal ethics is. I'm inclined to think that the basic underlying principles are universal, but that they get played out, you know, differently in different contexts. But Christian theology already has that sense of underlying natural law, but then that needs to be enacted slightly differently in different sorts of communities, for instance. So I would say, I'm not an ethicist, but my instincts go towards the idea that there are underlying ethical principles, which are generally the ones that actually lead to the flourishing of a community. But then there are all sorts of questions about just if the form of life, if the body, if the social structures of a different species were very different from ours, then it might be quite difficult for us to understand how those basic ethical principles played out.
So if speculating on whether aliens have sinned is eccentric, which I've got to be honest with you, it is a bit, speculating on whether they're saved is even more so.
I don't think it is that eccentric, because I think that if Christians were to say, oh, well, we're absolutely sure about sin, but hey, redemption and the love of God, that's a matter in dispute, we would have everything the wrong way around. Now, surely the Christian message is that the grace of God is even more prior and fundamental than human wrongdoing. So if we're going to allow any possibility that we should talk about sin and wrongdoing, we should definitely talk about grace and the love of God and redemption. That I'm absolutely certain about. I have no doubt about the salvific will of God. Whether other creatures cooperate with it or not and respond to the invitation, I'm not sure, but that's definitely something I would uphold above all else, that the love of God towards all things is not in doubt.
Good, good. So then that opens the way for this question. What does it look like for our intelligent alien species? You map out in the book various different potential options here. Talk us through them.
Well, a lot of it comes down to this question, which really was not discussed before the 20th century, which was whether there would be more than one incarnation. So absolutely central to Christianity, the kind of the clues in the name is the figure of Christ, and the idea that this is God taking up our human life and being united to it and sorting out its woes through revivifying it by taking on our life and our death and facing down everything that we face down with us. So my line on it is that God will do the right thing, and it's not my job to prejudge that. But there are still some questions we can ask. So some people ask about necessity. Did God have to do this? Did God have to do that? I think that's just the wrong category. It's sort of hubristic to think that we can work out, we can sit in God's throne and work out what God had to do. There are questions about possibility. Is it possible there could be more than one incarnation? And a fair bit of ink has been spilt about that. Some people saying yes, some people no. I certainly think it's not impossible. And that's quite a useful exercise, because it means we have to clarify our terms and ask exactly what it is that we mean. So we're not talking about a human being, Jesus, jumping from one planet to another. We're saying that what Christians think happened on Earth, which is that in this baby, actually man, the whole person of this person was God's own self. We'd be saying that a parallel thing of some other creature, that there was a Martian or whatever, which was that nature taken up by God's own person. So I do think it's worth thinking about possibility. I think necessity is the wrong category. But the thing that interests me most, which I think is the proper way of thinking about it, is the idea of suitability or fittingness. Mm-hmm. So it's a great medieval category. Augustine of Hippo, a great, probably greatest of the Western fathers, wrote an entire little book on the beautiful and the apt, or the beautiful and the fitting, which unfortunately had got lost by the time he wrote his autobiography, the Confessions. So fittingness is tremendously important. So the question really is, Is it fitting for there to be just one incarnation? Is it fitting for there to be many?
Mm. But how do you judge that? What's your criteria going to be about whether that would be fitting?
Well, I'm going to answer that question with my Star Wars analogy.
Go on.
So people know, if they've been to carol services, in the first chapter of Luke, there's a beautiful passage about the angel Gabriel being sent to Mary and announcing her pregnancy. Well, and Mary consents to it. And it begins, in the ninth month, the angel Gabriel was sent to a virgin, espoused to a man whose name was Joseph, whose name was Mary, in the town of Nazareth, and so on. And we know the story. I can almost reel it off from memory. Well, what if, as a thought experiment, there'd only been one incarnation in the whole universe and it wasn't on Earth, it was somewhere else? Now, I absolutely accept that that could redeem the whole world and unite the whole world, the whole universe to God. But what if the shoe was on the other foot and it hadn't happened here, but we were being told about it and being assured that it, you know, showed the love of God and redeemed us from our sins and so on? Then instead of opening Luke's gospel and reading those familiar words, we would open Luke's gospel and it would say something like, long, long ago in a galaxy far away, or is it long ago in a galaxy far, far away, this thing that you can't possibly understand happened to a creature you can't possibly understand, you know, and then 22 chapters of things that mean nothing to us because the body is different and the forms of life are different and the social structures are different and so on. And then you get to the end and it says, oh, by the way, this shows that God loves you and wants you to be with him forever. So it would suffice, but it just doesn't feel like, it doesn't have the kind of texture, the character of what it means, Christians say, to see God face to face in Christ. So is it absolutely necessary for there to be more than one incarnation? No. But does God do the absolutely minimal? No. The medieval's coming again. Look at the discussions that they have of why God became incarnate. And they'll say, to teach us, and it was to show us how to relate to material things, and it was to help us to see that human beings had great dignity, even if we often throw it away. And lots of different reasons. And some of those reasons don't work so well if the incarnation is this completely alien thing to us that we can't understand.
Throughout the book and in our conversation, you make a very strong case that there's no area of Orthodox Christian doctrine that's seriously challenged by the possibility of intelligent alien life. But you do say there may be an exception to this with regards to what Christians talk about as the doctrine of eschatology or end times. Tell us why that might be a bit different, why that might be a bit more strained by alien life elsewhere.
Well, my main argument there is that Christians have believed that the end of the universe is not a natural event, that it's not about things just running their course. So science has got all sorts of interesting things to say about what would happen if the clock kept ticking. There'd be the big crunch is one possibility, and the other is that the universe just expands faster and faster and faster until everything's dissipated and there can't be any more action. And the theological conviction has been that that's what would happen if things carried on naturally, but that God caused time on the universe. It's something interruptive. I don't want to throw that out from Christian theology. I think it's part and parcel. But if we think that the universe is full of life and that God has dealt as intimately with that life everywhere, or at least in many places, as with us, especially if you thought about there being more than one incarnation, then what changes is, It no longer makes quite so much sense to think that that interruptive end of all things would come in human history. And that's the big change. So I'm not suggesting this fundamental revision that you think that the end of the universe is just the natural one, but I'm saying that if there's life all over and God's dealt with it as with here, it makes less sense to think that that end is going to come in human history. But how disruptive is that? Well, Christian faith has always said you need to be living ready for the end. And I don't think that changes at all if the question is now cast on a much bigger scale.
The central theme that runs through many Reading Our Times interviews is, what does what we've been talking about tell us about the human condition? What light does it show? What perspective does it give on the human condition? What would your answer be to that?
In a section of the book that we haven't talked about, there's the question of theologians really overestimating historically how much life there would be elsewhere in the universe. So they tended to think that habitable places were made for habitation, and if they weren't habited. That was sort of incongruous. And there's a French theologian from the earlier 20th century who says, oh, well, it can't be that we're the only life in the universe, because that would make the plinth too big for the statue. Or this whole universe, and there's only life on Earth, that would be a plinth too big for the statue. And I, paradoxically, from a book that's about a universe full of life, one of the things that I take away from it is that that theologian is wrong. That human life, with our capacity for relationships with one another, God, acts of great selflessness and moral excellence and so on, for all of that, for the string quartets of Beethoven, for family life, for the fun of walking in the hills, the whole universe is not too big a plinth for that statue. So I think that's one lesson for me, thinking all this through, just the extraordinary phenomenon and value of life, of all life, which we should care for, and of human life in particular.
The book is called Astrobiology and Christian Doctrine, Exploring the Implications of Life in the Universe. Andrew Davidson, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest on your podcast.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Eve Poole about her book, Robot Souls, Programming in Humanity.
I mean, we've made tools before, my goodness, but we've never tried to make a tool that would replace us. I mean, that's extraordinary. I mean, it's very brave and ambitious, and we know from storytelling, possibly ill-fated.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can also find us on the website theosthinktank.co.uk. We're going to be doing a few live events at festivals in the coming months, so please sign up to the Theos monthly newsletter and join us in person for those if you can. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It'll help other people find it. Goodbye.